Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. You may have seen the recent Bill Moyers programs on PBS, On Our Own Terms, Moyers on Dying. Bill Moyers notes that modern medicine and social changes have prolonged life, but also transformed the experience of dying. 90% of Americans say they want to die at home, but in reality, 4 out of 5 of us will die in a hospital or other healthcare facility. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the work of hospices and the ways in which the dying, their families, and their caregivers can cooperate to balance medical intervention with comfort and humanity at the end of life. We have two guests with us in the studio. Ruth Madowick is a registered nurse and associate director of community care and hospice at Provena Medical Center, and Vera Duncanson is the chaplain at Provena Medical Center. We'll talk with them about the work of the hospice there at Provena and in general about the general issue of how to manage, as I say, medicine and quality of life and family and relationships at the end of life during this hour of the show. If you would like to join us, questions and comments, your own experiences are welcome. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's also 333-WILL, if it's easier to think of that way. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere, 800-222-WILL. Well, both of you, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Just to start, maybe Ruth Madowick, I could ask you to talk about the hospice, or both of you, if you would chime in, about the hospice program at Provena. It's the oldest in the area, yeah?
Yes, it was one of the first downstate hospices, and we opened 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we just celebrated our 20th anniversary this summer. And 20 years ago, hospice was something sort of revolutionary because a lot of people did die in the hospitals. Death wasn't really talked a lot about. And it really started kind of a movement of what is it that people want and looking at how can you make end-of-life care better. And I think those are still some of the premises that hospice is based on today. Probably one of the keys are pain management and symptom control, because that's one of the things people say that they fear almost more than dying is pain. And then also looking at the pain can be defined in lots of different ways, but a holistic approach looks at the spiritual, emotional, psychological, financial. And that's one of the strengths of the hospice team is that we have nurses, social work, physician, chaplain, home health aide, volunteers, pharmacist, who have I forgotten?
Dietitian.
Mm-hmm. So because that impacts not only the patient, but their family member as well, especially if they're caring for them at home. So we don't try to tell people what to do, but to be able to provide them with options and then support them in their choice as far as the care that they want at home, given that that they have a limited time left to live, that people try to do that in comfortable surroundings. I sometimes give the example, have you ever traveled? Tell me about the hotel bed, would you? Well, there's nothing quite as good as getting back home and you sleep better mm-hmm. in your bed. And sure. there is something to that for people who, you know, just the comfort of your own bed is, it's a lot different than being in somebody else's bed. And just being at home, the surroundings, it is more comfortable for families. There's more space, the dogs, neighbors, people can drop in and out. And people can look out and see their garden and other sorts of things that are what people tell us are meaningful. And I think that's the other thing is we try to learn from each person in what they tell us is important. We don't come in and say, this is what's important at end of life.
Right.
And we really need to take that direction from people.
Well, originally, the word hospice was used in the Middle Ages, and it was a resting place for weary travelers, and travelers would stop by there, and people would care for their body and their spirit. So this is really just a modern version of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that there has been such a change in the ways in which the end of life play out in the locations. As I mentioned at the beginning, you know, most people still say they want to die at home, but most people don't. Most people, you know, are in a healthcare facility. Can you think of any reason why it has to be that way? I mean, is that a better way to manage things? I mean, obviously you have all the resources that you can bring to bear there, but
I think sometimes it depends on people being given information with choices.
Yeah.
I think sometimes what's happened in healthcare is if people don't say what they want, we presume that they want intensive care and tubes and lots of things. And maybe it isn't what they wanted. But a lot of people haven't had discussions with family members about what they want. Just because medicine can do something doesn't necessarily mean that that's what a person would want to do. However, if they haven't left something in writing, haven't told their family member, when they're presented with a crisis in the emergency room or something happens, we go off on a track because it's a crisis, and somebody ends up dying in the hospital where maybe had they had the discussion earlier, maybe called in hospice, maybe had a home health agency, other sorts of things, if truly that's where the person wanted to die. But you have to have the discussion about where you want to die in order to be able to have that play out. And for a lot of people, that's still very, very uncomfortable.
Yes, certainly. I was just thinking of that because, you know, I'm at the age now where a lot of my friends, their parents are at the end of life. They may still be healthy in many cases, but that's not going to be the case forever. And we all know that. But yet we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to imagine it, much less talk about it. And I think sometimes the older people are more willing to talk about it than the younger folks.
It's incredible. That's what I hear people say, you know. Sometimes elderly people will give us opportunities to do that. You know, I can remember my mother's wanting to talk about it and myself saying, oh, Mom, that's a long way off from now. And really she was just wanting an opening for the discussion. So we need to give them that opening and enter into it with them.
That's interesting because I've seen and perhaps even done this myself. Oh, I don't want to talk about that. Let's not talk. We don't have to talk about that. But that's probably not the right thing to do.
Well, the comfort level is different for everybody.
Yeah.
And we have to acknowledge that in ourselves also. So I wouldn't want to be too hard on us. We've spent a whole century sort of denying this whole subject and not talking about it. So introducing it now is going to be a slow process, but it's happening. And I think the Bill Moyer special was really helpful in that. As a hospice, we've been trying to whittle away at that conversation for the past 30 years in this country. But getting others to enter into the conversation, it's really helpful.
Well, very good.
I think sometimes just acknowledging this is a tough subject. Is it okay? Sometimes in asking permission,
mm-hmm.
Is it okay, Mom, I saw this, and would it be okay if we talked about this a little bit? I'm kind of uncomfortable. And sometimes just in saying that, you can both acknowledge that it's uncomfortable. It doesn't mean that you have to sit and talk and get every detail,
right.
You know, for 3 hours now we're locked in. But sometimes you don't know what families want. For end-of-life issues. Organ donation is another part of that discussion, not necessarily related to hospice, but do people want to be donors or don't they? And some of Michael Jordan's publicity has helped to get that word out. It's a little more, it's still the same topic, just a little different focus. And so maybe you find out, oh, yes, they'd like to be a donor if they could. And next time they'd really like to die at home, or different treatment options, or things that people really don't want. Promise me won't have this.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those are difficult promises that we find. So sometimes it's I don't know. The promises are difficult because none of us know what the future holds. But at least it begins the discussion mm-hmm. for what people's choices would be.
Right. I think it's important just to take advantage of those times where you can talk about it. For some people, it may be at family gatherings. You know, Thanksgiving is a time to, you know, look at your blessings and to give thanks. And maybe it's a time to talk about what matters most to us in our lives and what we want to have carried on after we die and so forth. For others, it may be watching a movie on television where the subject's brought up and to say, hey, Mom, we've never talked about that. I would hate to be in a position of having to speak for you when I don't know what you want. So really take advantage of any opportunity that comes along.
Let's talk about the things that one might discuss. We mentioned a couple of things. You know, I guess, I mean, the way that Bill Moyers put it, I think, was in terms of making plans for the end of life, essentially coming up with an idea of what you want to have happen and making sure that the legal details are taken care of as well, because those are also issues. It seems like it's a pretty complicated thing, or it can be, if you don't pay attention to, you know, power of attorney and, you know, just things like living wills and how you feel about medication, where you want to be when you die. I mean, just all these things perhaps need to be discussed ahead of time.
I think sometimes we think that, oh, hopefully I'll just go in my sleep or it'll be a car accident. But that's usually 10% or less of the population. Mm-hmm. So most of us are going to have a debilitating illness or a chronic illness or something that we'll live with for some time. And I think sometimes it may be more difficult for people who are living with a life-threatening illness, because sometimes for them to have a discussion about what they want, they think in their own mind it means giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I have that discussion with mom, I think it means she's not going to make it. And so we may avert some of the kinds of discussions. You bring up the point about living will. I think that was one of the first legal documents that came out, and a lot of people had living wills. The living will is only effective if a doctor says you have a terminal condition.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're if you have a chronic heart disease, lung disease, ongoing, maybe even cancer, the living will doesn't become effective until you actually have a limited time left and the doctor says that the person is terminal. So if you're in a car accident and something happens to you, a living will probably isn't going to be helpful. So that's where the power of attorney comes in. And usually they call it a durable power of attorney for health care. There's also a durable power of attorney for property and for financial things, somebody who can sign your checking account. And but that's not to be confused with the health care. So that's something just for people to be aware of, that it's different. If you can sign on your parents, talking about your friends and their parents getting older, if you can sign for your parents on their checking account, it doesn't mean that you can sign for their health care.
Okay.
So that would be something separate, which is then different than someone's last will and testament. So the health care, which is what we would focus on, the durable power of attorney for health care, basically says if I can't make decisions for myself, this is someone that I would designate to make my decisions. And then there's the opportunity to put in writing the specific things you would want or not want, and also to have the discussion, hopefully with the person that you would name to make the person who would make the decisions for you if you couldn't make your own decisions. So if someone had a stroke or if their disease progressed and they were unresponsive and they're brought to the emergency room or something, who makes the decision?
Mm-hmm.
So usually the family and next of kin, if there is nothing in writing, then they're the ones who are next approached. If it's a parent and there are multiple children, siblings, and they can't agree, then that becomes difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because healthcare can't quite, you know, pick, well, we like these, so we'll go with them, and we're not. So then people can get into more legal and difficult situations in that sense. So the power of attorneys help people to have the discussion and at least have something in writing to be able to present to healthcare providers about what the person's wishes were and who's the person that they want to make their decisions.
Let me reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Ruth Madowick. She's a registered nurse and associate director of community care and hospice at Provena Medical Center. And Vera Duncanson is the chaplain at Provena Medical Center. We're talking about the work of the Provena Hospice and, in general, issues of death and dying and what one might think about when making plans for the end of life. And if you would like to join the conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Well, Ruth, following up on your last point, what happens when someone is, say, in an accident or has a stroke and they're brought to the emergency room? What is one of the first things you ask is, do you have a living will, power of attorney? I mean, these are things that are important to determine so that you can make good decisions.
It's one of the many things that the emergency room staff and physicians would look at or try to find out. What is it? If it's a car accident, the chances are that general things like people see on ER and other things, those kind of measures are going to be taken. The presumption is in our society, that's why we have 911, that's why we have the emergency system that we do. If you're in a car accident and something happens, our presumption is you want us to do as much as medicine can do to help your life because you were tootling along okay and then you had this traumatic accident. So in that sense, that would be the general thought, unless that would be the general trend, unless a family member or somebody stepped up and said, there's something else, please, we need to evaluate. But usually in the critical moments, they're going to presume to save life and do what they can in the emergency room.
Sometimes I think people don't understand when they say, I would never want a ventilator or respirator.
Uh-huh.
I don't want life support. They sometimes don't understand that you may be in a situation where that life support may get you through the next 8 hours, and then you can have a fairly good quality of life. So that has to be taken into consideration, too, when you do make your plans.
Very good. We have three callers waiting. Let's go ahead and include them in our conversation. And we'll go first to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I really enjoyed the Bill Moyers program. I thought it went into a lot of different circumstances in detail, and I liked all that. What I thought was interesting was the doctor who decided to not go with the details in his documents, but to give his wife what he called a naked power of attorney and talk with her about his preferences, but to leave it up to her to evaluate the situation and not be hampered by their guesstimates ahead of time about what things would be like. And I hadn't heard about a naked power of attorney before, but it seems to me to make a lot of sense. What do you think?
I'm not sure what state that was, and sometimes different states have slightly different legal ramifications. Basically, you could do the same thing here. The important thing, I think, is to have the conversation, and obviously he had with his wife in discussing the different alternatives and basically naming her to make the decisions. And that's sort of the key to this.
I would think you would also need to have backup people. He was looking at death coming up.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us who don't see that obviously on the horizon, I'm wondering if it might also make sense to have backup people with the power of attorney so that you can, again, cover more bases. I would think it would be very helpful.
You can. It's also something that when you have a power of attorney, it's not a document that can't be amended, which means that at some point in time in the next 10 years, your life may change and you may want to amend it. So I think one of the topics of this is sort of it's an ongoing conversation. Because a conversation you have with a family member today, your life 10 or 15 years from now may be different, and what we can do in medicine may be different, and your wishes may have changed. And so it's sort of an ongoing, periodic conversation. And I think the important thing is that each person needs to customize it and personalize so that their wishes and how they best feel. And if you'd like to name two or three successors, that's possible. First, I want so-and-so. If they're not available, then check with the next one and then somebody else. So,
I heard a good phrase that I try to keep in mind. Death is not optional. And something to that effect. We all are going to die. And the thing is, we just don't know when. Even somebody who's young and healthy could be, as you said, in an automobile accident, could have some unexpected, quick medical catastrophe that might leave them hanging. So Well, need to deal with this and not think of it as giving up, but I can see where that would be something that would be difficult for folks. Thanks very much for being there. Bye.
Thank you. We will go next to a listener in St. Joseph on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I have a question. I have a durable power of attorney over my body or whatever you call it. And I would like to know, is it necessary or is it a good thing to keep it on file with your doctor?
Yes, it's a very good thing to have it on file with your doctor. Also, if you have a copy or the person who is your agent also has a copy. So if at some time you would need it. Some people also leave copies with their attorneys,
Depending
with their other legal documents.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably not only having your physician, so that your physician has a copy, but having a conversation with the physician, because what we find is that life presents us with situations that aren't quite as clean cut as it might say on paper.
Right.
And having that discussion with your doctor so that you feel like, oh, good, we're on the same page. This is good. I actually talked with a physician this week who has had many patients come in and have the discussion this week after having seen the Bill Moyers and going away feeling very relieved that they felt that the doctor was on the same page with them and sort of they'd been carrying a burden, but they didn't realize they'd had this burden. So I think it's been helpful.
I have another question, and that is I have, for example, I'm just going to use myself because I know myself best, but I'm sure this refers to a number of other people. I have no member of my family living close to me. What do you do in that situation? I have nominated one of my sons, but he lives in New Jersey.
I would think you would have a backup plan here also in case they're not able to reach your son. If you have a friend who's close by, for some people it might be a clergy person who has, you know, you've had this conversation with.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. We're about at our midpoint in our conversation with Ruth Matawick and Vera Duncanson from the Provena Medical Center, talking about the hospice program there. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others. And the number again around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, this is Jan Shepperson, and hi to Ruth, and hi to Vera.
Hi, Jan.
I have three things to say. I love the Bill Moyer special. One of the points that you made, I don't know which one of you, about the conversation, but it's very important to talk and to understand. And the second thing I want to say, somebody called in and said death is not optional. That is true. But misery is not optional. I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say. And thanks for being there and for being you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Jan. Bye. Jan Shepherdson, for those of you who don't know, started the conversation in this community. She was one of those who is the founders of our program. And it's her philosophy that really has guided us for the past 20 years, that this is a subject that has been neglected, and she has brought this subject out with a great deal of grace and dignity into our community. So I want to say thank you to her for that, and thanks for calling, Jan.
Well, the point that she made there at the end in terms of suffering, it being something that obviously people don't want to go through for a long period of time, but it is also something that obviously modern medicine has extended our lifespan a great deal and changed the circumstances of the end of our lives, but also given us perhaps better tools to deal with, you know, the suffering aspects.
From a technology standpoint in pain medication, that has been the case.
Yeah.
We now have medications people can take, sustained release medicine, so that they take it twice a day instead of having to take something every 2 or 4 hours. That helps people's quality. They remember it. It provides a sustained pain level release. Otherwise, your blood levels are going up and down and up and down and up and down, and people are experiencing pain. So from that point, technology has been available and helpful. There are pain pumps, implantable devices, things that we can do for the physiology and the biological components to pain. I think we're also making strides. Some of them are things from ancient days, like being there with someone, touch, holding the hand. You don't have to be a massage therapist, or although that's very helpful. But some of those things that are also in looking at how people suffer or how that is perceived by different people.
Relieving suffering can come in a lot of different ways. But we've come from this period where we haven't talked about it, and I think even just being able to talk with each other relieves a lot of suffering for people. They don't have to keep it to themselves. But from the spiritual aspect, we've learned an awful lot in the past 30 years that suffering can be addressed through prayer, through touch, through music, through... We help people to take a look at their own spiritual resources, and they may or may not be religious. But for some folks, it's having visits from people from their church or listening to hymns, prayer, or laying on of hands. It's a really holistic approach that cares for the body, mind, and spirit. And together, I think we've come a long way in relieving suffering, but you can't relieve suffering totally, and I think that's sometimes our frustration, but it's reality, and sometimes people need to hang on to some of that also.
We have another call to talk with in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. In this discussion of the right to die, I'm glad you just mentioned pain pumps and some palliative devices, because it seems to me the emphasis has been too much on controlling death rather than controlling pain. There's a medical specialty called palliative care nowadays, and it's a very sophisticated specialty. In fact, the first episode in Bill Moyer's series was on palliative care. And the advantage of palliative care is that we can control pain. It appears, I've heard professionals talk, there isn't any pain they can't control. I know that there are some people in the medical profession that will tell you that there are certain types of pain that they simply can't control. Well, in the palliative specialty, they will tell you they can control any kind of pain. And the reason that's so important is because there's a danger in the idea of controlling death rather than controlling pain that we have already seen in places like the Netherlands, where people are afraid to go to a hospital because they are afraid they're afraid the doctor will take the initiative and kill them. I know a nurse who broke her arm and would not go to a hospital. Now, this is a nurse, and she's a sophisticated elderly woman. She would not go to a hospital to get her arm set because she was afraid they would kill her. And that's right here in the United States. So the medical specialty called palliative care, I think, is the answer rather than attempting to control death. This attempt to control death puts us on a slippery slope where people are, especially elderly people, are afraid to go to the hospital, and they shouldn't be.
You bring up the topic of palliative care, which is actually an outgrowth of hospice care. It is now looked at as a specialty. There are actually some medical schools here that are providing rotations for physicians to be trained in palliative care. Its focus is to alleviate pain, and they've done a wonderful job. I think that the point about alleviating pain is the focus, and I think that all patients, regardless of whether it's surgical pain or pain from something else, that the focus for pain relief should be beyond just those that may be dying or at end of life. Mm-hmm. So I think that palliative care has helped to bridge that gap beyond the pain expertise that's happened for people at end-of-life care and hospice and bridge that further for others. And I think that's excellent.
The caller raises a point that we really weren't discussing, you know, in terms of the decisions to end life. That is, and the reason I wanted to follow up on that, though, is I think that there's a tendency for folks to hear something like that and maybe respond in a way as sort of an urban legend about, you know, someone who went to the hospital, you know, for a tummy ache and, you know, was, you know, euthanized or something. This is not something that hospices practices. This is not the purpose of a hospice whatsoever. Just also a statement.
It is correct. The tenets of hospice and the National Organization for Hospice and Movement throughout the United States clearly states that we do not hasten death, nor do we prolong dying. So that is the focus and the tenets of hospice. We do look to provide quality care for people regardless of the time that's left in that short time.
Okay. Well, very good. Just to make that point. And then we also have another caller we'll get right to. Let me mention that we have just about maybe 12 minutes left with our guests, Ruth Matawick and Vera Duncanson from the hospice program, actually from the Provena Medical Center and the hospice program there. We're discussing issues of death and dying and hospice care. We have a few more minutes if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm on my car phone. I hope you can hear me. I have pulled off.
Okay. Great.
In fact, I'm due at a luncheon, but I'm so interested. We've just been through the death of my mother in another nearby city, and she was in a hospice program near the end. I just wanted to share my experience. I was part of the volunteer hospice program when it started at Mercy and worked with Jan Shepherdson. And our experience with my mother, who was nearly 88 and had dementia, and so all of the healthcare operatives that we had signed were put into effect. My experience was, of course, that hospice made a great difference in keeping her comfortable. There was one problem, and I just want to share. Hospice has changed, of course, and we were surprised to find that there was such a thing as a contract with Medicare and the nursing home where she was living. And so when her doctor thought it was necessary and that she would meet the guidelines for hospice care under those situations, she went on to a hospice program, and it made quite a difference. Now, she had been in assisted living for 2 years, and we had caregivers around the clock for 2 years, and we continued them in the nursing home because, of course, they don't have enough help. And she became, we had to use the Hoyer lift to move her and so forth. She never had a decubitus. She was able to get up for a long time. After she'd been on hospice for perhaps 6 weeks, she showed enough improvement that they rather suddenly told us that she would have to be terminated from the program. And I was a little shocked at this, but I didn't protest because I understand their guidelines and you must follow them. But she obviously was in a early terminal situation. And so within about a week, she needed to be back on. And I didn't quite know what to do. I kind of waited, and finally the nursing home staff suggested that she go back on the program, and so she did. But it took quite a while. And after she was back on, the comfort measures were operative, and obviously she was more comfortable, but then she only lived about another week, a very long, slow demise. And in that time, the hospice measures the last 3 days were very helpful. But I just raised this as I'm still struggling with this in my mind. Hospice makes a great difference, but I wish they hadn't terminated. treated her, because we had a period of about 3 weeks where it would have made a difference. Do you have any comments that would help me?
Anytime we have a doctor certifies that they think that a patient has less than 6 months to live, which those are the guidelines that we operate under, those are best guesstimate in a sense of where a patient is. We have on occasion had people who have actually done much better and improved. Sometimes it may be due to the increasing pain control. Pain does interfere with lots of things in people's lives, and if their pain's not under control, they can't do very many things. You get the pain under control, and many times they can do lots of things that they weren't doing. So they may appear to be getting better.
Well,
and
their
indeed,
vitals had improved, and that's apparently
right.
What they were going by.
Indeed, sometimes people do. We've had people who have been, we say, sort of graduated from hospice, and many of them have lived on for months, maybe years. Sometimes then we've had people who sort of their condition deteriorated again. I think the thing that's difficult is none of us at the times that we make a decision know what the future holds. And so at that one point in time, trying to make the best decision, not knowing that maybe 3 weeks later her condition was going to deteriorate again, as you described.
The improvement was not dramatic when they took her off. It was, she was well within a 6 month prognosis. Of course, I understand.
Yeah.
It's tentative, but oh, I just wished, you know, we could have kept her on. I still am struggling with that period in which she needed the hospice program, and you know, it just makes such a difference. It really does, and I was just grateful to them. But hospice has changed, you know. It to me, it almost has become a business, and I had to adjust my thinking to that. But I'm all for the program. Well, I just wanted to share this. I don't know whether there would ever be an attempt to try to deal with the type of situation we have had or not. But
there are some potential legislative changes. One of the things that hospice has, and many of the different agencies that try to discuss things at congressional hearings, in looking at extending the criteria for longer than 6 months, we, on the one hand, want to have better end-of-life care, but then there are the criteria that sort of box things in.
Yes, what we're dealing with, I realize.
And so from a legislative perspective, that has been put forward as far as expanding some sort of hospice care so that it's longer than 6 months. What they've found is that many times, for the most part, patients under hospice care, most of them do not exceed that time limit. It's not really a time limit. It's sort of a guideline.
I know. I understand. I think total she was in the hospice program less than 3 months. Probably more like two altogether with both admissions.
And that seems to be the national trend, which also creates a problem if people are only in hospice for a couple days or a week, because you're not really able to connect with the family and really able to do the kind of pain management and end-of-life care that allows people to have the discussions and to say goodbyes and to really sort of get things in place. It's kind of a last-minute crisis. And
in our situation, my mother was not able to communicate with us for a long time.
Uh-huh.
So it was difficult to try and interpret her restlessness as
sure.
If it was pain or not. And yeah. So it took some of the, it relieved me of some of the sense of responsibility. Okay, well, I appreciate very much your program, and I, too, enjoyed that Moyer show. It spoke to me. I'm struggling with why she had to go through this long period, you know, suffering. And I'm dealing with a lot of the emotional aspects and the spiritual aspects, and I felt very comfortable with the hospice people. And so I'm really a supporter. Thank you so much. I'm due at a luncheon.
Okay, well, thank you for calling.
Bye.
All right.
The whole area of grief is another huge aspect of hospice, and I think especially when people look back and think, what if, or could this have been differently, it makes grief a little more complicated. But hospice provides grief support following the death of our patients for 13 months, and also through our Center for Grief, Loss, and Hope, we provide support and resources for everybody in the community. So I really... That's a huge area, in addition to the pain control and caring for patients as they're dying, is the aftercare that we provide.
We have groups for children, for teen, for infant and perinatal death, family member that may have had a death by suicide, and adult groups. So there's a lot when you look at grief that's beyond just hospice. When you focus it at truly end of life, because that may come in lots of different ways.
We may have time to follow up on that. I have a couple of questions, but we also have a listener. I've been making wait. We'll conclude them in our conversation. This is someone in Ottawa on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. My question is for your chaplain. I'm really interested in her role, her activities, and what she sees as her priorities as a chaplain in a hospice. And maybe contrast those a little bit with a hospital chaplain, which probably most people are more familiar with.
Well, actually, I do both, but primarily I do hospice. My role really varies. Again, our program is tailored from individual to individual, and that's the way spiritual care is. For some people, even the word chaplain is a little scary, because it comes with a lot of religious baggage sometimes if people have had a difficult experience. So I'm the chaplain, or I'm the spiritual caregiver. I'm somebody who listens. My role is to assess the needs of individual patients and families and then to really go from there. A lot of what I do is being present with people, listening to people, sometimes helping people to sort through what matters most in their life, how they want to spend the time that they do have. Sometimes issues like forgiveness come up, or how do we celebrate together. Sometimes it may be helping people plan their funerals, or actually doing their funeral for them. Another part of my role is I coordinate the grief support groups for the children, so it's that ongoing kind of care also. But the role is varied and interesting, and I think any of us who work with hospice would say what a blessing it is for us to be a part of people's lives at this time.
Are you ordained?
No, I'm not. I'm a lay chaplain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the question. You mentioned issues of forgiveness and, you know, the family. It seems like there would be, I imagine, a large challenge in essence, coordinating or maybe facilitating a way of people communicating around what may be a crisis or maybe a prolonged crisis. But, I mean, is this one of the challenges that you do, that you mm-hmm. try to fulfill, is sort of facilitating or, you know, bridging or trying to get people talking to deal with this and perhaps come to some sort of closure?
Right. I think that's a challenge for all of us on the hospice team. Sometimes I'm not the one in there, but it may be the nurse or it may be the nurse's aide or the volunteer. So all of us look for opportunities to be able to help build those kinds of bridges with families. Sometimes it gets done and sometimes it doesn't get done. You know, we see families for a very short period of their life, and there are, in some families, forgiveness issues that go way, way, way back. And sometimes we are able to help facilitate that, but that is a huge challenge.
We just have about 3 minutes left, and there are a whole bunch of things we could talk about. It just strikes me that in looking at this and thinking about it, and I note some figures that came with the Bill Moyers special that show the change over the past 100 years in the way things play out at the end of our lives. In 1900, the age at death average was 46 years. Mm-hmm. Now it's 78. That's 32 years longer in one century. A century ago, the leading causes were infection, accident, and childbirth. Now it's cancer, heart disease, and stroke. And whereas disability before death was very unusual and brief a century ago, now it's on average more than 4 years. This is a major change in our society and the way that we're experiencing the end of life. And it seems only perhaps not surprising that we're having some adjustments to make about how we go about dealing with that.
Dying is taking a lot longer than it did at the beginning of the century, or I guess at the beginning of the last century, I should say, when illnesses took people very quickly. And I think that is a huge issue for all of us, is to help people to deal with the fact that illnesses are much longer and chronic today, and how to provide that kind of palliative care along the whole process.
The just sort of to wrap up in talking about the hospice program itself, what would you perhaps, and I'll direct this to Ruth Madwick, what would you suggest for people if they want to learn more and maybe start thinking about the kinds of conversations they ought to have, some of the resources that perhaps they should be aware of?
They could call our hospice office if they wanted, which is 337-2273. And depending on their question, it could be diverted if someone was interested in volunteering, volunteer coordinator, if it was something from the Center for Grief, Loss, and Hope. If it were more of a medical question, one of the nurses could answer. So depending on their specific question, they might get a different team member. The other thing is that we're going to be having community conversation meetings. There'll be three of them. The first one will be next Monday, September 25th. All three will be, we're doing this in conjunction with a public library in Champaign, from 6:30 to 8:30, talking about how to have a conversation and how to talk about dying, also what kind of advance directives you might need. Then on October 16th, we're going to have a discussion about controlling pain. What are the losses that people experience and family members? And then how people dying at home, how people can be helped in order to help a family member to do that. Then the next one, October 23rd, is about having hope and celebrating life. And that will be something looking at sort of individual things and spirituality and what that means for people. And then the next week, November 6th, will be November is Hospice Month, National Hospice Month, celebrating that. We'll have Doug Smith will come, and he's a divinity graduate, I believe, and he's going to talk about patient stories, what the dying people want to tell those of us that are living. And okay. I think we learn a lot from them.
Okay. So if people want to find out more about that, they can call the hospice?
Right. 337-2273.
Okay.
I'd also like to say that our Children's Grief Support Group starts September 28th, and anybody who is interested can call at 337-2470.
Okay. I wrote those numbers down in case anybody wants to call after the program. We're going to have to stop since we're here at the end of our time, and just want to say thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Ruth Madwick and Vera Duncanson from the hospice program at Provena Medical Center.